The pace is picking up at the Montana legislature. A Senate committee has begun its work on the state's main budget bill, less than a week after receiving it from the House. Welcome to Capital Connections. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. This week, we'll check in with Senate President Scott Sayles. But first, an update on funding for early childhood and special education.
I want to welcome Representative Kathy Kelker of Billings. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about a couple of issues.
Well, it's always fun to talk to you, Jackie, and especially if it's the things I'm passionate about.
Let's talk first about pre-K, because the bill is up this week, and I'm curious, you know, why did you decide, knowing going into the 2017 session that money was going to be tight, and to add this funding for pre-K education?
Well, from my perspective, as someone who has worked in the field of pre-K, we can't just let up on the pedal. I do understand that we have a budget challenge this time, and I'm not greedy normally, but we are really lagging behind in Montana in preschool early childhood education. We're one of only six states in the United States that doesn't have publicly funded free preschool education for four-year-olds. And some of the states have had that kind of opportunity for years and years now. And we have plenty of long-term evidence that it is more than helpful in terms of getting kids ready for public schools. And it to me, it just doesn't seem fair that children in Montana don't have that same opportunity.
Because your background is in early childhood education, perhaps you can help our listeners and remind them why this has become so important in this day and age.
Well, it's important for a number of reasons. Obviously, it's a good thing for kids, but to be more practical, there is evidence that preschool education is a good investment economically. You're probably familiar, and maybe some of your listeners are as well, the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis did a very extensive study on the investment in early childhood. And they put sideboards on the early education. It had to be high quality. It wasn't just,
babysitting
kind of thing or daycare. It was really early childhood education. But on the basis of their research, they found that the investment of $1 in early childhood brought at least $7 and sometimes as high as $17 of economic benefit to the communities that had that opportunity for children. And the reason for the economic benefit is that if a child starts out well in school, being well organized and having the readiness skills that are expected these days, they are less likely to have difficulty learning to read, are able to read by third grade, which is the ultimate goal, that they're less likely to need special education, which can be very expensive. And as they get older, get into the teenage years, they're less likely to be early parents, less likely to get in trouble with the law, and more likely to graduate from high school. And all of those things are predictors of life success as an adult. So what you're doing is providing a very solid foundation for youngsters who otherwise might not have that, just simply because they haven't been exposed to the kind of information and vocabulary and skills that are part of an early childhood program.
Do you think in some ways it has been talked about it's economics that is driving whether or not a young child has access to, you know, learning to read and write and colors and all of those things, and I'm talking about economics of the family, of whether or not they're able to afford to send their child to, say, something like a Montessori school or a private preschool.
Well, the evidence over the last 30, 35 years is very clear. You can predict on the basis of family income which children are going to be successful and which are not. There are, of course, exceptions. especially with immigrant families. Sometimes immigrant families have a low income but are very keen on education and go to great lengths to make sure their children have the information. But in general, it is easy to predict which kids are going to struggle in school on the basis of economics.
Another economic factor that has been brought up as perhaps a benefit for working families is it takes the strain off of trying to come up with those costs for daycare, which in some instances equal or are greater than, say, college expenditures.
That is very true, unfortunately. In Montana, the estimate for one child in daycare for a year is $7,900. That's a lot of money out of almost any paycheck in Montana. So it is very difficult for families to just have their children in daycare, especially if there's more than one child. And then to add to that expense, perhaps having their child be in a preschool program is just out of the question for most of our Montana families.
Some of the opponents have expressed concern about whether this is mandatory. And I'd like for you to address that, because they feel that they can homeschool or it's through the family that the children are learning many of the skills that would be, I don't know if equivalent is the right word, but they would argue that, you know, their child will be ready once they hit kindergarten.
Well, this program that's being proposed by the governor is totally voluntary. So there's no concern about, you know, having to send your child to preschool. It is true that some families are able on their own to provide the kind of environment for learning that has the child really ready for kindergarten. But we have to think about 21st century school skills. It's way different than from when I went to kindergarten. There are no toys. It's pretty serious stuff. And now in Montana, it's a full day program. The children are expected to have behaviors, social behaviors, that allow them to be fairly independent learners. And that is a big step. They also typically, most of the children learn to read, or at least are beginning readers, by the end of kindergarten. So if they have very low vocabulary when they go into kindergarten, acquiring reading skills is very difficult. Not to say that some children can't do it, but a lot of kids can't. And so you don't want a child to enter school for the first time and already experience failure, because they don't have the skills that are required. That's one of my greatest concerns. You want every kindergartner to feel like they're part of the mix and that they are going to learn. Most kindergartners believe they're going to learn to read. You know, they just sort of think that. And if that proves to be a struggle for them, it sends them the wrong message and starts them out so poorly for success. So we got to fix that problem for those who have it.
And I also have to bring up the urban-rural divide. Communities like your Billings, your Missoula, your Helena, your Bozeman, there might be a greater wealth of opportunities versus, you know, folks who are living, I'm not trying to pick on communities, you know, say Terry or Plentywood, for example. You know, how does, I guess, what the governor and what you envision having those resources, they can reach children no matter where they live and where they're at?
Well, this bill requires that the grantee, whatever organization gets the grant, is a public school. And every community, the small communities included, have a public school. So that's your anchor. That doesn't mean that the public school has to actually provide the program all by itself. The public schools may want to contract with a local private preschool, and as long as they meet the standards, that's fine. That would be great. But it is true that the urban communities have more options for families, but they're for pay. They're a cost. And so that's the limiting factor for families who don't have the money to go to those options. they're stuck even if they live in an urban environment.
I'd like to dovetail, if I could, toward you're also advocating for funding for special education. It's almost this, you hear this in committee, well, the federal government is not living up to its obligation. And so in providing the funding that has been promised, I put that in quotes. And so, you know, where does, I guess, when you look at helping children where they're at, what roles and responsibilities do you see the state playing?
That's really a great question, Jackie. Let's start out with the federal piece. When the law was passed in 1975, which is a long time ago now, the promise from the federal government was 40% of the cost. And that helped sell the bill because at the time, a lot of the youngsters who needed special education were actually in medical facilities, which were very expensive. So roll forward in history. The highest that I can remember a federal match was like maybe 19%, and around that now it's more like 14 or 15% of the cost. It's never been 40%. So that is a legitimate complaint that folks have. However, there is federal money involved. And the thing that I think is difficult in Montana is that the state funding for special education has remained relatively flat since maybe 1989. I mean, a fairly long time. It hasn't gone up with costs or, you know, by any sort of measure. It's a lot of money, but it still is not keeping pace with what inflation would tell you, at least that much. And what happens is that at the local level, because the program is mandated, the local folks have to kick in. State law requires 33% of the cost to be local, but the average general fund amount for most of our public schools is 41% plus. And with the fact that special education did not get an inflationary increase when everyone else did, that's even worse now for special education. So I would say the state hasn't kept pace with its responsibility, and it's been turned over to the locals.
And that can be uneven.
What really happens is it's a shift in cost. It's a shift to local taxpayers, and then it's a shift to the general fund, which means that there's less money in the general fund for all children because the special ed needs have to be met. There's a requirement in the federal law that you have to maintain efforts. You can't do less unless you have a big drop in your student population.
Well, let me just circle back around to my first question. In this session where projected revenue is tight, what are you saying to your constituents on these two issues?
Well, in terms of special education, that issue came up in the Commission on Public School Funding. That was a group that met in the interim between legislative sessions, and the charge of the commission was to look back 10 years and see if Montana is doing a better job of equal funding and adequate funding. And pretty quickly in our discussions, it surfaced that special education hadn't been properly funded during that 10-year period. In both the lawsuits that were settled in favor of the school districts, it was mentioned that special ed was behind. But the judges involved said, you know, if you're making progress, if you're working on that, we won't make that a big issue. Well, the progress hasn't been made, and so it had to be mentioned in our report. Looking back 10 years, we still have a problem. So bills came out of that commission, and guess who got to carry them?
But their issues you're passionate about.
Yeah, it is my passion. There were three bills. One was for the inflationary increase. One was to help the special ed co-ops, which is a whole different subject, and then one combined both types of funding. The co-ops serve rural communities, and they really have an important duty. Individual small school districts could not possibly provide the array of services that are needed for certain special ed students, like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech, and so on. So the rural districts form these co-ops and then give their block grants for related services and special education to the co-op to spend on the services that can't be provided in the school district. And they've worked relatively well for a long period of time. But again, their funding has not been increased. There's been a 5% amount for since 1992 for the special ed co-ops, and that's supposed to cover their administration and recruitment of staff and their travel. Travel is a big expense for co-ops because they cover big areas.
Right, many schools.
And they have to be competitive to get the professionals that they need, so they can't really scrimp on benefits and salaries and so on. So some of the co-ops came to the commission last summer and said, you know, we're close to bankruptcy. We're not going to be able to continue doing this unless we have an increase. And all of the professional organizations involved with public education in Montana came in and said, this is our highest priority. Not just the special ed people, but the administrators, the teacher union, you know, just all of these various groups said, we got together and said, this is it. We're all putting our eggs in this basket because we can't carry on like this with the general fund being tapped so strongly for special ed. And with the co-op, that maybe will have to dissolve because they can't carry on their work.
So I'm just going to play this out. If the 2017 session adjourns and does not address this, are you hearing then that there's no other option but to go to court?
Well, I'm actually not hearing that particularly, but it has reached a point where it's become very serious for general education. This that you just don't have a solid floor of state funding for special education. And I would say that the crisis is more in the rural areas.
Let me ask you then a big philosophical issue. Is it a state responsibility to help all of Montana in this area of special education, or do you go back to local control?
There is state law that requires special education, and it mirrors the federal law almost to the word. You know, it's very, very similar. So by the state's own laws, it certainly has responsibility. It's supposed to be a shared responsibility, and I think that's reasonable, and a local match is reasonable.
But along with federal dollars.
With federal dollars, whatever they may be. But the state, I think, does have an obligation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd like to welcome the president of the Montana Senate, Scott Sales of Bozeman. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Jackie.
And what I'd like to visit about is now that we're past the transmittal break, we're past the halfway point, and the House has finished its work on the budget bill, House Bill 2, and now it's the Senate's turn. I wanted to get a sense from you of how you see this budget bill finally starting to shape up. In the past, the House has cut, the Senate has either added money back or rearranged priorities. What is your sense for the 2017 session?
You know, I don't think it's going to be a whole lot different. You know, the first 45 days of the session, when all the general House bills have to be over to the Senate and vice versa, the general Senate bills have to be the House. That's the easy part of the session. The real heavy lifting comes in when you have to match revenues with the appropriation bill. And now, you know, we're ahead of schedule by, I think, about 10, 12 days, the House getting House Bill 2 over to us. So, you know, it's a jigsaw puzzle of sorts, trying to forecast what revenue is going to be a couple years down the road and try to match that with spending. And typically in the past, the Senate, since it has the last bite of the apple, tends to have a little bit more say in how the budget turns out. Historically speaking, when I was in the House, we usually sent a more pared-down budget to the Senate. They stuck more money in it and then shoved it down our throats. And that's kind of how, you know, it's worked in the past. This session, I think, is going to be a little bit different, maybe in a sense that I think there's, you know, less money that's going to be put into House Bill 2 than in previous sessions. At least that's what I'm hearing. But, you know, the details are, there's a lot of details that remain to be seen. So, but you're pretty much right. That's kind of how the process has worked in years past. And I think it'll probably, you know, will mirror that to some extent.
What's different, certainly with this session, is the chair of the Senate Finance and Claims Committee is right next to your office. Do you feel there's more communication, perhaps coordination between you as president of the Senate and the chair of the Senate's money committee?
Senator Jones has been, to this point, has been extremely good about keeping me informed of what's going on in the appropriations process through Finance and Claims and the Appropriations Committee in the House. In fact, I was just in his office a minute or two ago talking about, you know, we just got a revenue estimate today that shows that we're, according to our staff, Legislative Finance Division, it looks like we're going to be about $106 million over what had been forecasted. You know, that's always a better thing than a worse thing, that maybe, you know, that the tax revenues will come in. Obviously, I've been a fiscal conservative since the day I showed up here. I've tried to get government to live with us its means. I would love to see a tax decrease for, you know, the businesses and individuals out in the hinterland. But in this session, and quite frankly, it's been quite a while since the taxpayers of Montana have seen any relief. 2007, we had what I called a gimmick at that time, but it did provide about $80 million worth of tax relief to property tax owners. And I don't think in any large measure we've given any money back to the taxpayers since then, and that was just a one-time only thing. So government has been growing at the expense of the private sector for a long period of time. But if we can get out of this session, like I said from the very beginning, without a tax increase, and we can get out of here a few days early so that we might have the money set aside and the time set aside to come back for a special session to address you know, the repeal of Obamacare, if and when it does happen, or a federal infrastructure type bill, or, you know, other issues coming down for the Trump administration, then we will have accomplished, you know, two of my major goals right off the bat.
You brought up a lot of things. Let me back up just a little bit. I want to go back to the revenue estimate. Certainly there are those who are advocates for long-term care for seniors, whether it's university system funding, I could go on and on, are saying they could use some of that revenue. On the other side, you have the Bullock administration still wanting a $300 million ending fund balance, basically a cushion, right, in the checking account. Your thoughts on that? I mean, have you started any negotiations with the administration to see where you might?
Well, certainly the Finance and Claims Committee chairman has had ongoing conversations. I've had a couple conversations with the governor, too. Not to any great degree on where we're going to end up with the budget, but yeah, obviously he's a more left of center Democrat that would like to see more funds for the government so that it, you know, may not have a hiccup down the road if revenue doesn't come in. But, you know, it's a guessing game to know what the economy is going to do 2 years from now. So I actually am under the persuasion that it's a good thing when the legislature comes back and takes a more critical look of where the money's been spent and are we achieving the goals that you know that were set forth in the bill that created this program or this agency's goal. You know, I'd like to see, you know, a larger, more robust private sector economy where people can buy their own health insurance and they're not on food stamps and all those type of things. So, and the other thing is you don't always get everything you want in life. I've been at this is my seventh session, so I've been up here quite a few. I can't think of really a whole lot of things I've gotten on my side, you know, on the more conservative side that would like to see, you know, a less robust government and lower taxes. But you know, hope reigns eternal, and we'll see where it all ends up. But nobody gets what they all want, doesn't get everything they want. So, you know, if we could come out of here with a $200 million ending fund balance without a tax increase, we've done, you know, limited, you know, most of these cuts that I've been associated with over the years, they're just cuts to the rate of growth. They're really not cuts. This is the only place where a cut is actually you get more money. You know, in my world back home, a cut is, you know, you might have $50,000 and this year you're only going to have $40,000. That's a cut. And here, your budget was $50,000, you're asking for $60,000, you get $53,000 and you got cut $7 billion. So I'll just stop at that. You know, I don't think we need a $300 million ending fund balance to get government through the next couple of years. And you know, I don't think anybody's ox is getting gored too horribly bad with this budget. And so, you know, a lot of details remain to be seen. A lot of stuff's going to be worked on. They're going to take on three sections of the budget this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then the last two items, which is C and D, are on Monday. And the plan is still to have House Bill 2 on the Senate floor the 3rd and 4th of April, which is 2 weeks from today.
Right. And let's go right to that. There's talk in the halls, as you can imagine, that you would like this legislative session to wrap up by Good Friday.
I think there's a fair possibility. If we can get this work done this week and turn out a pretty good product. There's a lot of moving parts. We haven't talked at all about infrastructure. We haven't talked about the potential gas tax. There's a major bill to shift how a lot of like the HESRA account is funded. So
Coal strip.
There's more than one issue still to be dealt with, but we still have 4 weeks even to get out of here by the 13th, 14th, 15th, which the 14th is Good Friday. I think there's a genuine possibility that we could be out of here in 4 weeks, which would trim probably roughly, I don't know, I haven't calculated, but I think that's almost 12 days off the session. So it'd be, you know, like day 78 to day 80 in that range.
Certainly takes coordination with your counterpart in the House.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're not going to leave them high and dry. But there's no reason why we can't get all our work done in the next 4 weeks the way it's going right now.
So you feel in some ways is the fact that there's not a lot of revenue out there. Does that make it easier then?
I think it does make it easier because it sets people's expectations that there's not going to be a bunch of additional spending. I think this is the smallest amount of bills that have been actually not created, because we were well over 2,000 down there again this session. But my understanding is that I'll just say we're introduced or available for a bill hearing, at least amount since 2001. So, a lot less bills, I think. And also, I think people, you know, we've had, which for 12 years now and going on 16 by the time Governor Bullock's term's up, we've had basically a Republican legislature. A few of those years we had, Republicans weren't in control of everything, but the majority of the years we have been. And we've had a Democrat executive branch, and I think people are starting to catch on that, that makes for, more limited expectations of what you're going to get accomplished, hopefully on both sides of the aisle.
Well, with that, I have run out of time. I want to thank you so much.
You bet.
Senate President Scott Sayles of Bozeman for joining us.
And it's always a pleasure. Thanks, Jackie.
You've been listening to Capital Connections. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. Our theme music is courtesy of the Alex Nauman Trio. Capital Connections is a production of YPR News.